This is great somber music and rainy music. I want to just take a big old nap today, Bill.
Take a nap.
Did you bring your nap mat?
I didn't bring one, but feel free. If you need a nap, you deserve it. Take a nap, please.
You know what was the best day of getting ready for kindergarten? This is the one thing I remember from my childhood. Going to pick out a brand new little nap mat.
Oh,
it was
a
cute little rug that
I
brought.
Which one did you go with?
It was multicolored.
Nice.
Very soft.
But then no matter what you're wearing,
it would match.
It matches. That's a very smart move. I, of course, did not attend kindergarten. Why? Because I am ambidextrous.
Here we
Hi,
go.
Everybody. It's Bill and Wendy. Welcome to the show. As Wendy pointed out, it's a little on the misty side today, but it's supposed to be nice in July.
I like the way you describe that. Misty yeah. and nice in July.
Yeah. Well, you know what? This is a nice bridge to. Did you see any of the royal wedding? Although the weather in England was fantastic, but normally you look outside on a day like today. This is British weather is what we're experiencing.
See, that's
right now.
What I didn't know because I've never been there. I know you and Steve Bertrand have been there,
mm-hmm.
But they were comparing it to like a beautiful LA day.
Yeah.
Warm, sunny, blue sky. Is it typically not like that?
No, it's always damp.
Hello.
It's always damp there. Even on a nice day, it's a little misty and damp. And it, you know what? It works for England. When you're tooling around England, you almost want it to be that way. I don't know why. It just makes sense.
Because the castles look like that.
I think that's it, Mayor.
They're
I
just
think
dreary,
that plays into
you know,
it.
Damp and stone and
yep.
just
I think
you
you're
know,
onto something.
Moats, the whole thing.
There's a lot of moats. Tell them, Wendy, at your house, tell the village that you're putting in a moat.
I want a moat. Kinda, a pool? Kinda, no, a moat.
I want a moat.
Can you swim in a moat?
You shouldn't. No.
Can you emote in a moat?
Yeah, you could do that.
Did you get up to watch the wedding?
No, I didn't get up, but I watched highlights later in the day. How about you?
I got up at 6 to let the puppy out, and then I turned on the TV, and it had already happened, correct?
Yeah.
I don't remember. It was like 4 in the morning or something.
Something like that, yeah.
But then I started watching it at 6 a.m., and I couldn't pull myself away.
You know whose coverage I enjoyed thoroughly? On HBO, they did a thing with Will Ferrell and Molly Shannon where they played two characters named, what were their names? Cord and Tish, I think were their names. So the background on this was Will Ferrell's character, Cord, was a guy who does, he usually announces parades. And Tish was a former beauty queen from some state. She won the Miss Missouri contest or something like that. So they were sent to England to cover this for HBO.
Were they great?
It was so funny.
Cord and Tish, you're
yeah,
right.
Yeah, that's their names.
Damn it, I forgot
it's
to
really
watch
funny.
That.
I think HBO is still rerunning it throughout the month. But if you have a chance, even if you watch a little bit of it, because they improvised it for like 90 minutes or 2 hours. And it's they gave out all kinds of facts that weren't even close to being accurate. It's really funny.
I can't wait to see that. I don't know what station I watched. I can't remember the people's names.
I'll give you, here's a question that
it was
might
Harry.
Help. Harry?
Well, no, I know the
Harry
bride
and Meghan.
Groom.
You're right, Steve. If what's Oprah's friend's name? Gayle King?
Yeah.
If Gayle King was on it completely out of her mind, it was CBS.
Nope.
She was
ABC?
So excited. Who did it for ABC? I'm not sure who did it for ABC.
I just was watching it and
Is it Robin Robinson?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She does a good job.
She did a great job.
Yeah, she's always good.
I loved Meghan Markle's dress. I know everybody on Twitter is all a Twitter.
Mary's not happy with it. I'll tell you that right now.
All right, well, let's talk.
I was fine with it. It was just,
You said boxy and boring or something?
Yeah.
It's a bandeau neckline, which is very flattering. And she, as I heard on the coverage on ABC, that she prefers that type of top. It was a sheath style, completely fitted and beautiful. It looked satin, and it was very plain, because if you notice the veil that was 18 blocks long, if she had any ornate dress on, it would have taken away from
right.
all of that.
Right.
It was picture perfect.
Well, the tiara was very complex.
How do they keep the train part of the dress from getting really, really dirty? What do they
The little
need?
Kids all carried it.
The kid with no tooth.
The kid with no tooth.
There were twins. There were two kids.
Both without a tooth?
Loved that kid.
I just noticed the one without a tooth, but they were identical. They look. I'm like, what is Macaulay Culkin doing these days? Is
actually,
that him?
Only one was missing a tooth. They had to take a tooth out of the other one.
to balance it out?
So they matched.
That's absurd.
Yeah. It won't hurt a bit. Where are the pliers?
It was Britain who needs teeth.
But there were twins that carried the main part of the veil, which was represented like 13 countries or something.
Oh,
I read about that.
Nice.
It was really long.
Yeah.
And then there were a bunch of adorable little girls with flower around their heads. Like hippie things, and a couple other little boys in suits, and they were just adorable holding hands. It was just the most amazing thing.
Those, I know they look young, but those were all members of Parliament, Wendy. Did you know that? Each one of them, even though they look really young, they were all members of Parliament.
I did not know that.
So they were there during the beginning to carry the train, but then when she left the cathedral, she and Harry just kind of walked, and it just trailed behind her on the ground. And you can't return that now. It's impossible.
All right. First of all, no one's going to return it. That's something you want to keep.
I'd return it.
I'd use it as curtains on my porch. That's what
I would use. That
would
look nice.
The nice sheer.
That would look so nice.
Second of all, who cares if it gets dirty after the ceremony's over?
I guess. But won't that go in a museum somewhere?
They can dry clean it.
Yeah.
It was so light and wispy and airy that it probably didn't drag that much. It floated.
Yeah. I bet it did.
And could he not be more adorable? You know, one of my favorite pictures from my wedding. Yes, I'm turning this back into about me.
It should be about you.
And I was not at your wedding, but I wish I was, because my favorite view is the groom's face when the bride's walking down the aisle.
Yeah.
I love that more than anything in the world.
Yeah.
It's sweet. He was smiling. It was just really awesome.
That's the only specific moment I remember from my wedding.
It's the first time you saw Sharon.
Right.
You go, there's this moment of realization where you just go, oh, I did it. We pulled
this
off.
Well, not yet. At that point.
Or what the heck am I doing?
Oh, yeah, maybe.
Mary is so half empty.
You got to look at the other side.
But our photographer captured a picture of Jim just with his hands, you know, crossed in front of him. And just the look on his face. I've never seen that look again.
Yeah.
Damn it.
Yeah, that's
a moment,
isn't it?
I better be nicer to him. But yeah, I love doing that. And next time anybody's at a wedding, which June is a really big wedding month, please look at the groom as the bride is walking down, because it's just a magical moment.
I remember saying, wow, I thought I said it to myself, but my groomsmen all agreed that I said it out loud and way louder than it should have been said. But as I saw Terry for the first time in her wedding dress, I just went, wow, like that. Like,
aww.
And it should have probably been internal, but I couldn't help myself. I couldn't help myself.
That's pretty sweet. Did you utter a word, Steve, or just the look on your face was like, wow?
Yeah, it just was like a wave.
Yeah.
You know, boom.
Yeah.
On the bride side of things, I literally felt like I floated down the aisle.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even remember walking down the aisle. I just remember looking at the aisle, looking at my husband-to-be, and I don't know how my brother walked me down, and I don't know how I got down there.
Well, I was there, and there were bungee straps on you that I didn't remember being there.
Like Peter Pan.
Yeah,
awesome.
The same people who did Peter Pan orchestrated.
Well, my name is Wendy.
It worked out beautifully. All right, let's do this. We'll take a quick break. And there are more talk of the royal wedding. Want to join in? 312-981-7200 is the number. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. You know, we're talking about the royal wedding. If you missed it, it was on Saturday. But you can see it online. A bunch of websites show it. The dress that Meghan wore during the ceremony was beautiful, unless you're Mary, and Mary says it was boxy and boring. And it was a little traditional, you know, but then she wore a second dress to the receptions that was dreamt up by Stella McCartney, Paul McCartney's daughter.
So did she wear gym shoes? Because Stella's really popular with the gym shoes.
She wore high tops, yeah.
Did she really?
No.
Okay. I never know when to believe you. Why don't I ever learn?
And that dress was really, really pretty.
Well, the veil I mentioned, it's a headpiece. It was made from silk tulle, featured a trim of hand-embroidered flowers from each of the 53 counties in the Commonwealth in threads and organza. A couple personal touches as well. She had winter sweet, which was flowers, which grows in the grounds of Kensington Palace in front of Nottingham Cottage.
Mm.
And California poppy, the state flower of California. And I heard that Harry picked some of the flowers for her bouquet.
Oh, he did? How princely of him. If you had the queen wearing lime green in your office pool, you are a winner this morning.
Oh,
congratulations.
How hip is that?
Lime green.
That is one of my favorite colors. Never in a million years would I have guessed the queen would have worn that.
It's a little vibrant.
And who's that guy with her?
That would be her husband.
How come he never gets mentioned?
Who did you think would escort
her? I knew who
her?
It was, but...
The Weeknd?
What's his name?
Philip.
Oh, yeah, I guess. No one mentioned him at all. It was all about the Queen.
He looked like he would rather be anywhere else. Like, every time they showed him, he's like, all right, already. Come on.
It was a lengthy sermon.
It was, well, yeah. It
Stand
was
By Me was awesome.
Yeah.
How cool was that?
Nice? That was really nice.
Very contemporary. Again, nothing I'd expect for a royal wedding.
It's funny you say that, very contemporary, because the song is probably 50 years old or so.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, but usually wedding music is like 150 years old or
especially
200.
Especially a royal wedding.
Yes.
Where they want to honor the past. And when I say the past, I mean the 15th century.
Right.
They like going deep into the cuts.
Into the songbook?
Yeah. And.
This is one Henry played for Anne.
Right. We'll all remember this. Let's all hum along. The Chicago preacher who went up there with his sermon, it was outstanding.
It was great.
But it got kind of unusual mixed response from the people there in the church.
Can I just tell you, I can't speak from experience because I'm not a priest, but I just know a lot of times when a priest or a preacher or someone of the cloth mm-hmm. goes up in front of people, mm-hmm. that's their time to shine, and it's sometimes hard to wrap up. You know what I mean? This is your moment, and it's like,
right.
This is kind of my stage right now.
So do they give him a time limit? Do they say, we need you to, here's how much time you have, go to town? Or how do they work that? Do you know?
I think they leave it up to the person, yeah.
All right.
And I think the biggest highlight of the day, I'd have to agree with Dave, who has called us. Hi, Dave. What did you like?
I liked the cars. I thought the cars were awesome. The Rolls Royce that they pulled up in. Then everybody got, a few people got dropped off in a Rolls Royce, and then they took the Jaguar to the reception. Those were cool.
Nice cars.
Those were old cars. Those were classics.
Yeah.
Those were unbelievable.
No Toyota Tercel. They were all really high-end.
Jeez.
Wouldn't that have been something?
Yeah. Something else. I don't know what.
A Dodge Challenger. Wouldn't that have been fun to see?
The Pacer had a lot of window space.
Right.
Well, Dave, I'm so with you. The cars really stuck out. It was just really, it was beautiful. It really was.
Yep.
I don't care that much about weddings now that I'm married. Dave, do you attend weddings? Are you married, first of all?
I am, yes. 26 years.
Congratulations.
Good news.
Thank you.
When you go to weddings, are they still fun?
I haven't been to one in a while, so yeah, I guess they're fun. Sure, why not?
Just after mine,
so, Wendy,
after my big spectacle that I enjoyed, it's like, I don't know.
Oh,
I'm kind of done with weddings.
All right,
Dave, thank you very much for calling.
Thanks, guys.
You sat near me at Kevin's wedding, our former producer's.
Oh, I liked that one.
That was a fun wedding. Yeah,
that was unique. That was, I guess I do like weddings.
All right,
that was a great wedding.
Yeah.
For a while, though, after we got married, we had a couple friends and family members who got married like a month after ours, and it's like I was still floating on mine.
Oh,
you know
what
I mean? So I guess now I enjoy them again.
All right, good. It took a little while, but you're back in it.
Yeah, thanks. It took 30 seconds.
So,
thanks.
Listeners, if you have a wedding coming up or someone you know, invite Wendy. She's a good time at a wedding.
I have a good time at a wedding.
Yeah.
If there's an open bar.
Yeah, that's the decision maker.
Have you ever been to a wedding where there's a cash bar?
Yeah.
You have?
Yeah,
I
a few
not.
Of them. Yeah. All right, let's do this. We'll take a quick break, some news, and then a full show. All kinds of stuff coming your way next. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. Steve, thanks. Watch this segue, everybody. See if we can pull this segue off. Wendy, have you seen any good theater lately?
Funny you mentioned that, Bill. I went to the closing matinee performance of Jesus Christ Superstar at the Lyric Opera House last night. It was fantastic. I love musicals.
Do not tell me how it ended. I have DVR'd it. Now, with that said, here's one of my favorite segments on the show. It's called Guys I Went to College With Who Are Doing Way, Way Better Than I Am. David Cromer joins us right now, a friend of mine from Columbia College, who just got nominated for one of those Tony Awards that all the kids are talking about. How are you, David?
I'm good, Bill. How are you, Wendy? It's great to be here.
I'm glad you're here. I bet that was the best introduction you have ever gotten.
I'm so proud of you. I was just telling Wendy just a little while ago, when you and I went to Columbia College together, you were one of those people that I would watch and I'd say to myself, this guy's not just going to hit it, he's going to hit it big. And you have. You've done wonderful for yourself.
Thanks. So, it's so great to be on the show. It's so great to be on WGN. The last time I was on was very sad.
Yes.
Sad circumstances, because our teacher, one of our professors from college, had just passed away. But now I get to enjoy the honor of being on WGN.
Oh, that's very nice of you. And David is referring to the great Sheldon Patinkin, who for years and years and years was one of the stalwarts over at Second City and really crafted a whole generation of people, you and me included, and made us realize how comedy is a viable option. If you want to do something, the theater and comedy theater is a way to make a living. He really changed our lives, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Now, and here we are.
Here we are.
And you've spent most of your career working in Chicago theater. Is that true?
Most of it. Yeah, yeah. I was in Chicago until 9 years ago. I'd done a couple of plays in Chicago that New York producers had moved to New York. That a producer named Scott Morphy, who was always coming to Chicago to look for things, he brought shows with Michael Shannon to New York. He brought Tracy Letts, plays to New York. He was really instrumental. He was really coming to Chicago to champion the work there. And he brought a bunch of my shows. This is a longer answer than you wanted. He brought a bunch of shows there, and I came with a show 9 years ago. He brought a show that I did in Chicago with the Hypocrites, at the Chopin Theater, real Chicago, real storefront theater, and moved it to New York. And then I was in it, and I started getting other work, so I just stayed.
For people who don't know, the highest accolade in theater is being nominated for a Tony Award. Winning is nice, too, but just to be nominated is amazing. Go back in time a couple weeks, David, when you found out you were nominated. What happened there?
We were, there's only so many shows on Broadway in a year, and there's a bunch of nominations. So you all sort of secretly think, gee, I wonder if we're going to get, you reasonably have a shot. If you open a show on Broadway, because there's only so many shows, you think it might happen. And, I don't know whether this is just the way I was raised or whether this is a Midwestern thing. I think it is a Midwestern thing where you sort of have to go like, no, I don't know. We're not going to, not going to get nominated. We don't want that, and people here are a lot more kind of success based, and they're like, I think it's going to happen. I think it's going to happen. We're like, no. And, so we were actually, to be perfectly glamorous, it was Broadway week on the Today Show, and it was we were performing a number from the show on the Today Show. When they do those things out in the plaza, where people stand around with signs behind your gentle, quiet, and physical, shouting Savannah Guthrie's name, and they told us on the air. So that was sort of
wow.
They told us we were nominated, and they were getting it. And they said, "You have 6 nominations." No, you have 7 nominations. And Savannah Guthrie's getting it in, or no, Hoda's getting it in her ear. Because actually, we have 11. So
wow, that worked its way up.
An exciting way to find out.
Yep,
exciting way to find out.
11 nominations, and this is your first nomination for a Tony Award.
You see how I worked that number in?
Yeah.
In my modest Midwestern way.
Wow, from 0 to 11.
0 to 11, yeah. Yeah, it is. It's my first. I was in a play 4 years ago, a production of Raisin in the Sun, starring Denzel Washington, that did won several Tonys for best revival of a play, and 2 of the actors won. I was in it. I was in a Tony-nominated production, but I wasn't. I've never been nominated.
And, David, where would we know Denzel Washington from?
He was in a little thing called with Jack. I wish I could call up the name of that movie he was in where he plays George Segal's son.
Carbon Copy.
What's it called?
Carbon Copy.
I can see you two were friends at Columbia.
Oh, yeah.
Can I just say that?
Yeah. Carbon Copy with George Segal and Denzel Washington. So that's where.
You're
oh yeah, now
sick.
I know. Now I know who that is. He's very talented. He was also in St. Elsewhere.
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
We have very high hopes for him.
Yep.
All right,
it might be hard to break out of television.
We mentioned 11 nominations for the band's visit. I need to know what this is about.
Okay. Oh, can I say one thing quickly, which is one of the nominations is for Chicago actress Katrina Lenk, who is playing the lead in the show, who I will tell you about, for Best Actress in a Musical. She's from Chicago and only moved to New York here 7 years ago.
Wow.
Ben's Visit is based on an Israeli film from 2007. It was almost got Best Foreign. It was excluded from, well, that's a boring story. It's a terrific film. It won a lot of Israeli Oscars, which is called the Ophir Award. And it is just this very quiet, very gentle film about a sort of a strange sort of travel misunderstanding. And a lot of people say it's a pretty unlikely, people keep saying it's an unlikely choice for a musical, and it kind of is. It's about an Egyptian a police orchestra, kind of, you know, like within the police department, within their police department there. It's, you know, it's like a ceremonial orchestra, you know, the police bands. We have Chicago police orchestras. And it's about a police band that's traveling from Egypt, traveling to Israel to play a concert. And they're going to a town called, play the concert in a town called Petah Tikva. And there is a mix-up at the airport, and they are sent to a town called Beit HaTikva, which is in the middle of nowhere. So they're stuck in the wrong place. They are, you know, Egyptians in Israel. There's no hotel. There's no bus until morning. And their embassy can't help them. And the locals take them in and for the night. And they leave the next morning, and that sounds, and they just spend the evening with the locals. And it's, you know, it's seemingly very little happens, and really a great deal happens. And it largely is a story of a friendship that is a pretty deep love story of between Dina, played by Katrina Lenk, and Tufik, who is the leader of the Egyptian orchestra, who's played by Tony Shalhoub.
Oh, I love him.
Nice.
Yeah, she's fantastic. She's fantastic. And they, it's about these people who, they, none of them, they don't speak each other's language, so everyone is speaking in kind of broken English.
But also music is the universal language too, isn't it?
Exactly. Ultimately, they're able to bond over things like music, in multiple scenes and in multiple ways. Music, food, shelter, just the things people need and the things people like. And then they struggle to communicate about their disappointments, their expectations, their hope, their loss of hope. And it's just, and it follows all these other characters too through the night. And it seems like very little happens. They just come, stay the night, and leave the next day. But everyone is kind of improved, purged a little bit, upgraded. Everyone is able to get past a little block they might have had that was holding them back. And it's very moving. And I don't say that about my work. I just say that about the story. So I love the story. I tell it badly. I'm sorry.
No. You told it, bro. David, I have to say there was a little element of what you just described that I think makes the best stories, where you just said seemingly very little happens, but in reality a lot happens. Those are the best stories, aren't they?
Yeah. And those are, most stories are like that, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. No one turns into no car turns into a robot, or, you know, there's no infinity stones, you know,
but these are the stories that we can all relate to.
Exactly.
Human emotion. Yep. And yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a very gentle show, and it is a patient show. And, it is, you know, it's composed by David Yazbek, who wrote Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, and he wrote the musical of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. He wrote the musical of The Full Monty. He wrote Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown.
Wow.
He's going to be in Chicago this summer with the pre-Broadway production of the musical of Tootsie, which he's writing. But really, David Yazbek wrote Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego?
Oh.
So just so
there's I get it now. There's your crown jewel right there.
He will never escape the fact that he wrote the theme Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego.
That's impressive. David Cromer is our guest. We'll talk more with David. He just got nominated for a Tony Award. How
11.
About that? Well, David won, but the show 11.
Okay.
David gets one. The show gets 11. Stick around. If you have any questions or comments, we're at 312-981-7200. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
I love musicals. I really, truly do.
You got to meet David Cromer, Wendy. A friend of mine since college. David's done right well for himself. His show, The Band's Visit, just got nominated for 11 Tony Awards. He himself nominated for the first time as a director. David, I know you still act and you're a director, and I know the process is very different. We always hear actors talking about their process of going into a role. What's your process when you know you're going to direct a show? What's your next move?
That's a great question. I have to spend a lot of time with the script. You first can just spend a lot of time with the script and try to make note of the things you picture happening, of the things that the images that stick in your head, like certain things you see might, you know, stupid things. Someone's in a yellow raincoat or something. You have to grab onto the things you see.
Yeah.
You have to think about all the possibilities of everything it could be. Then you're going to go into a process where you find out. Anything's possible when you're first reading it. So make list of everything that's possible. Then you're going to start meeting actors, and that's going to narrow the everything's possible. It's going to expand it in other ways, but it's going to narrow it in other ways, because it's going to be like, now what's possible is this person or this person or this person. So it focuses you. Then hopefully you start to let them tell you, once you bring in the actors and the designers, let them tell you things and add that to everything you saw. And collaborate, you know, because I can say, I know this is exactly what this should be, but I'm not, you know, but if you listen, if you have great artists around you and you listen to them, then it can be sort of even better. So yeah. There's that. And then, you know, then you've got to go into, you've got to design, you've got to cast, and then you've got to just all see if any of the ideas work. You know, and fail and try and fail and try and fail and try and fail. It's you sketch it, erase it, sketch it, erase it, sketch it, erase it until something sticks. As they say about a lot of things, you never finish. You just run out of time, and then it opens. You know?
Sure. Yeah.
The Tony Awards will take place Sunday, June 10th, 7 p.m. on CBS. Have you attended the awards show before?
I never have. I never have. And I don't get to do what I usually do, which is to go to a friend's house and drink wine. So I am unfortunately going to have to go to the Tony Award. And it's like 4.5 hours long.
Yeah. Yep.
And yeah. So
do you get a meal or some drinks, or do you have to just sit there?
I don't think so. I think we're a studio audience.
Oh, bummer.
Who will you be wearing, David? Yeah. Have you chosen who you'll be wearing?
What will I be wearing?
I'm sure you've thought a lot about it, though. This is, you know, you got to figure out what you're wearing. A lot of thought has gone into that.
I've got about a lot of thought and no action. That's the way I roll.
You still have time.
It's like a new play. I'm sitting around thinking about all the possibilities, and eventually, so I really do. Every day I find an excuse not to go tux shopping.
Then
you go like, you know what? That's not really an actual problem. There's people who have real problems in this world, and that's not one of them.
Are you going to rent one, or do you own a tux? Are you going to buy it?
I think I'm going to buy it.
Good for you.
You should buy it. You owe it to yourself. Buy it.
I can't. I might go to Genghis. Is Genghis formal wear still?
We can do something with Genghis.
I was just going to say that. You don't want to show up and win an award wearing a rental from Genghis.
The last time I wore a tux, I rented it from Genghis formal wear. I was hosting the Jeff Awards, which is the Chicago Tony, the Chicago Theater Awards. I was out at the Park West. I was hosting. I went to Genghis. And you have to get it back like the next morning, like right away.
So I know.
You wasted it, the thing. Because you had to get it in like at 10 o'clock the next morning.
Or you get fined big time.
Let's stop. I'll stop promoting Genghis. They're fine.
No, they love it. You've been nominated for a Tony Award, David. They're thrilled that you're talking about Genghis formal wear. David, you've mentioned some big names in the last half hour. Tony Shalhoub, Denzel Washington. Yeah. Who are you itching to work with? Is there an actor or actress somewhere that you'd love to direct or star along on Broadway?
Besides Bill Leff.
Besides me.
Boy, oh boy! Besides Bill Leff,
yeah.
Well, you know who I want, who I haven't acted or I haven't worked with since college, but I would love to have in a play again, is Scott Adsit.
Yeah,
our Scott Adsit. But that's not. Let's see. Like Rachel Weisz, who does a lot of theater.
Yeah.
Rachel McAdams. I'm thinking about that movie Disobedience. It was so good.
Yeah.
Another Rachel, perhaps.
Another Rachel
from Friends.
Rachel from Friends. Yeah.
Scott Edson, for people who don't know, is best known for his work on 30 Rock, but he's all over TV and movies and stuff, and he's a very talented Chicago actor who, wouldn't that be fun?
Yeah, that would be amazing. You know, I want to work with, I hopefully will be working with Oscar Isaac next year, who I think is amazing.
Very talented.
That's a really good question. You know, if you're talking fantasies, the big dog is Meryl Streep, but you know,
that would be all right, wouldn't it?
I would be terrified. I would be absolutely terrified.
Would you? Yeah.
Well, yeah, of course.
It could happen. I mean, come on, you didn't know that you'd be nominated for a Tony. Things can happen, David.
Hey, they can.
And you're coming back to Chicago. You're going to do a production here in Chicago.
I am. I'm coming back to for the first time in a long time, so I'm excited to come home. I'm going to go to Writers Theater in Glencoe and direct a new production of Next to Normal, the musical Next to Normal, which won the Pulitzer and it didn't win the Pulitzer. Won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama in 2010, I think. And it's about a family dealing with a parent with a really, really severe bipolar disorder.
Oh.
And it's a musical.
Oh, excellent. Well,
you take some pretty serious things and turn them into fun, don't you?
or make them less fun.
One or the other. David, when you're in town, stop by. We would love to see you.
I will.
Absolutely. And Wendy, a quick trivia question. You know, in college, I had an improv group, Joint Void, that performed at Second City. Can you guess who designed the cover for our playbill?
Was it David?
David Cromer did.
It was me.
Yep. Wow. And that led to a Tony nomination.
direct line.
Yeah. A to B. It's easy.
David, you're a man of many hats, David.
Yeah.
Or tuxes.
Yeah. Tuxes in this case.
Yes.
David, many tuxes.
Stop by when you're in town.
I mean, I know I'm going to have a top hat on.
All right. That's all that counts.
Top hat on.
Are you going with the cane?
Top hat. Yeah. Yeah.
You are not.
You got to balance it out. Just a subtle walking stick.
Then people will expect you to dance.
You'll have to sing Putting on the Ritz at some point.
I think Putting on the Red. I'm prepared. This is an actor prepares.
We are all rooting for you on Sunday, June the 10th, as the Tony Awards will be on CBS at 7 o'clock, and we're all hoping beyond hope that David Cromer walks away with at least one and possibly 11 Tony Awards. David, great to talk to you. Thanks for being here.
Great to talk to you. Thank you so much for having me on.
Congratulations.
Absolutely. It's David Cromer, everybody. All right, we'll take a quick break and then more show. Stay here. Bill and Wendy, WGN.
Last night, once again, shots rang out on the town, seemed to have no end.
It's Bill Leff, it's Wendy Snyder, and we have a special couple of guests in the studio with us today. 30 years ago, the Laurie Dan shooting rocked a village, and we have someone who is a victim of Laurie Dan, Phil Andrew, in the studio with us. Phil, how are you today?
Good. It's good to be with you on this rainy day.
It is pretty ugly and rainy. You're director of violence prevention initiatives for the Archdiocese of Chicago. So you went from Laurie Dan victim. Then, as I watched your piece on WGN TV News, you went to the FBI. And now, starting in February of this year, you were appointed to a position by Cardinal Blaise Supich, which is where you are right now.
That's right.
All right. You've turned it around. A victim of the Laurie Dan shooting. People have really been revisiting it, obviously, with this 30th anniversary. And I feel funny saying anniversary, but that's what it is. She had started at a school, ended up in your house.
That's right. It was there was a lot that actually happened that day. And honestly, many weeks of preparation on her part in getting ready to attack the community. But if you'll recall, she sent poisons throughout the North Shore. She set a fire to a home and tried to ignite what we would call today a weapon of mass destruction, a cyanide gas device up in the a school up in Highland Park. And it culminated with her going to a second grade classroom and basically opening fire on children at point blank range.
This was unheard of when this happened. I mean, you couldn't even imagine someone walking into a school and shooting innocent victims. And look what's happening now. I mean, 30 years ago, you heard of it once in a blue moon, and now they're statistically saying, is it every week or something that there's a shooting at a school?
Yeah, well, it was a real grim foreshadowing of what was to come. There were a lot of lessons to learn from that day, and I think that in many ways we did try to learn some of the lessons from the standpoint of trauma response and even emergency response. Some police tactics, all of those things we were very careful to learn from. The things that we didn't really take seriously and have are paying the price for is not doing what we need to do as a nation to restrict access of dangerous weapons to dangerous people.
You've brought a student with you. Why don't you introduce your student?
This is Audrey Wright, and she's a student here in Chicago. And she's got her own vantage point on this. And one of the things that I've endeavored to do is the 30 years that have taken place since then, a lot of gun violence. The communities that suffer the most gun violence are urban. But I think it's important for us to really draw the connection that that these are not really distinct problems. They all have to do with access to firearms. They all have to do with people that are suffering from trauma. And in some places, folks are getting good services, and in other places, they're not. And there's a real deficit. You know, we really have two different cities. And I couldn't let this go on without drawing that connection. When we talk about school shootings, as tragic as they are, they're less than 1% of the gun violence that we see in the country. And of those 1%, two-thirds of those people that commit that violence, we know, and they get their guns from home. So in many ways, that's such a simple problem to solve. But urban gun violence, we also know who those folks are, and they all are also getting their guns in the community. And the destruction that it causes is just tearing up families and communities and schools. And we've got to talk about those communities too if we want to solve this problem.
Audrey, we're going to get to you in a second, but Phil, I'm just curious. You just said something that I think every time we talk about guns and mental illness and combine those two, it's a problem that should be easy to solve, and yet it's the exact opposite. It should be so easy to solve. It's not easy to solve. Why is it so difficult?
Well, this really comes down to one thing. It comes down to money. And sadly, we got a lot of things in this in our country that are just motivated economically. If you pull this among gun owners, even NRA members, they want background checks. They want people, the law enforcement, to have the ability to take a gun away from a dangerous person. They think that you talk to hunters. Hunters don't use these kind of weapons. You know, so there's a lot that we agree on. The only folks that don't are the industry that makes these guns and makes a lot of money selling them, and they're puppets that just sell fear to try to keep that industry propped up and making money while communities suffer and families suffer.
And you mentioned mental illness. It's a combination of things. It's mental illness needs to be addressed. Guns need to be addressed. But there are mental illness in other countries as well, and they're not having shootings like we are here in the United States.
Yeah, you could just go Google a couple of graphics, and you can see how we are just exponentially. We've just got so many more guns and access to guns, and that's the difference. Everybody else is watching the same movies. Everybody else is playing the same video games. They've got the same level of mental health diagnoses.
Yep.
There's a stigma attached with accessing mental health here in the U.S. that we've got to work through.
We're starting to.
We are. And I think this is a part of it, you know.
I thought the most telling moment, Phil, of the whole gun debate was a couple months ago when they had the town hall meeting and the kids from the Florida school had Marco Rubio up on stage with them, and they challenged him to say the simple words, I'm not going to take any more money from the NRA, and he danced around it and wouldn't say those words. And all he needed to do was say, I agree, this has gotten out of hand, I refuse to take any more contributions, and he wouldn't do it, couldn't do it.
That's the simple part. And that's, you know, one of the great things that Audrey and her friends with the groups that she's affiliated with and the student movement, which I hope you'll talk about, They are courageously leading the way.
Audrey, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to focus on what you'd like to speak about. Phil Andrew is with us, Director of Violence Prevention Initiatives for the Archdiocese of Chicago. Audrey Wright is with us as well. Phil, just before we go to break, I do want to mention that how many times were you shot by Lori Dann, who did enter your house? You were shot, and she proceeded to go to an upstairs bedroom and committed suicide there. Where were you shot?
I was shot in the right side of my chest. The bullet passed through both my lungs, my esophagus, grazed my pericardium, hit my pancreas, my stomach, and it got lodged in my left lat. That's one round at close range, and that's the level of destruction that it caused. Now, I had no idea that that's the destruction it caused at the time, but the lethality of weapons and the capacity of the weapons used has only grown exponentially since then.
I'm so glad you're with us to continue your service now to help solve this problem. I'm sorry to hear that. Phil Andrew, Director of Violence Prevention Initiatives for the Archdiocese of Chicago. Audrey Wright. Audrey, where do you go to school?
North Lawndale College Prep.
All right. We will come back and speak to you because this is definitely a problem in this country. We're not going to solve it today, but we can certainly talk about it. It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder at 720 WGN. And a couple of special guests in the studio with us today. Phil Andrew went from being a victim of Lori Dann, then on to a crisis negotiator with the FBI, and now currently director of violence prevention initiatives for the Archdiocese of Chicago. Cardinal Blaise Supich appointed him that position in February of this year. And Phil brought Audrey Wright with him. Audrey, you're a junior at North Lawndale College Prep, correct?
Yes.
We have talked about school shootings before, wondering if students are afraid to go to school thinking about this. And what are your thoughts? Are you afraid to go to school?
I won't necessarily say I'm afraid to go to school because I know at North Lawndale we have a student support system called Peace Warriors where we help not only attack violence in our school but as well as out of our school. So when we see a student come in who looks like they're having a rough day, we'll take them somewhere to talk to them. If they don't want to talk, we just leave them, make sure they can, you know, get their stuff together, and then maybe later on that week or that day, they'll come back to us and let us know, like, what's going on, what's bothering them, and we'll be there to help them through emotional support. So, I mean, a lot of kids come to school as a safe place. You know, school
should... That's their escape.
Yeah, that's their escape, and to know that, to hear that a lot of schools are being shot up and a lot of kids are dying, that kind of brings a lot of anxiety. But being a peace warrior, we kind of have like a sixth sense, so we know what to do in those type of situations. We know how to talk to those kids when they're feeling some type of way about like what's going on. And we basically are there to let them know that you have support in and out of school. It's not, this is not just a school thing. Peace warriors help in and out of school.
And Audrey, just to be clear, these conflicts are resolved by students, by the peers,
yes.
not by faculty or guidance counselors.
It's easier to talk to another kid than
an adult.
Yeah.
A lot of kids rather come to peace warriors than go to the counselors. We have two counselors at our school, one counselor per two grades. I mean, their office
not
is
enough.
Always full. Yeah, it's not enough. So we kind of wear that extra cap that says counselor to help take some load off of the counselor's hand, and the kids come find a peace warrior and talk to us about whatever it is that's troubling their mind, their heart, whatever it is.
A lot of things have been talked about in the news that perhaps schools should be more secure. There should be less entrances. There should be metal detectors. I don't know if that's the answer. You have metal detectors at your school?
Yes.
How does that make you feel going into school? Do you feel safer with them?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, yes, to know that just in case someone does bring a gun into the school, they can stop them right at the entrance. But no, because it kind of brings the fact that it kind of makes us feel like criminals when we're not. I mean, going into school, you should go into school knowing that you're here to get an education, not to get a background check. So those type of things that you incorporate in school to make us feel type of safe, school should be safe right when you walk into the doors. You should need metal detectors to know that your environment of school is not, it's not safe, you know. So those metal detectors kind of bring a negative connotation to the word school. So
I never thought of it that way, I have to be honest with you, and I'm glad to hear that coming from you. What about the area around your school? Do you feel safe in that area?
To be honest, no. I take the bus to school sometimes. After school, I get dropped off before school. And like after school, we do see a lot of gang activity going on. We do hear a lot of gunshots during school. We do hear a lot of police flying down the street, a lot of ambulance happening during passing period or during class. And that kind of disturbs the learning environment to know that something is always going, and it's every day. We hear police flying down the street. We hear ambulance. We hear a lot of those sirens going off, and it kind of disrupts the learning environment. And then when we get out of school, to know that something that happened earlier can probably still be happening when we get out of school. And a lot of the kids, they rather stay after school to know that like it's a particular time that they know that they should go home, but they can't because it's a learning environment. Yeah. So they kind of tell us, oh, you have to get off school properly. We want y'all to go home because something can happen. So.
How tragic is this, Audrey and Phil? The other day, Friday, we saw another school shooting, this one in Texas, and they asked some of the kids how surprised they were by this, and they said, you know, we weren't that surprised. This didn't really shock us. It's come to that, where somebody can move through your school with a gun and shoot at people, and the kids aren't that surprised. On top of all the other tragedies, that's a tragedy in and of itself.
Well, I feel like, yeah, You should feel that type of way. A kid's perspective, you should feel that way to know that stuff like this has been going on for so long, and a lot of kids don't really understand what's really going on as far as how these kids are getting a hold of guns.
Yeah.
And to know that it's like, well, me personally doing research, I found out that it's money over lives. So to know that people are actually out there purchasing guns just to have one, but then you give your child a gun and they go to school and you shoot up the school, like, what's the purpose behind it?
Yeah.
So. And we have school shootings and we have shootings in the urban communities. What do we do? I'm asking both of you. We have a student at high school, Audrey Wright, and Phil Andrew. What do we do to stop this?
Well, you know, I would go back to what Audrey says is what Peace Warriors is doing. You know what? They're there and they're listening. And, you know, sometimes when you got a big problem, you gotta slow down and you gotta listen to people, and you gotta listen to people that are most affected. And right now in this country, we've got students who are afraid, and we are not listening to them. They've been saying this for a long time, and I know that we need to keep order in schools. And usually, we're telling people to tuck their shirt in and get in line, but this is a time to listen to kids. And kids are afraid, and we've got to understand what they're afraid of. And if we don't bridge that gap to start listening to kids and understand that, we're not going to do what needs to be done, which is to protect them. And our number one goal has to be making sure that kids are safe from gun violence. And that's going to require us to do some tough things and take on the lobby. But the other thing is to listen to them about the things that they know are solutions. They want adults and students in the building that are caring for them. So Peace Warriors is sort of like necessity is the mother of invention. They came to do this because they know they needed to survive. And I think that solution is part of this. But that kids need to be listened to. Our policymakers need to listen to them and start doing what they say they need to feel safe. And it has something to do with this restorative justice model that they've implemented at North Lawndale Prep. We know that those restorative justice and peer-to-peer empathy-based training works. The evidence is already there. And we also know that background checks and many of the other gun policy proposals that are up right now, we know that they work.
I know we're out of time. I just want to ask you really quickly. It's been suggested, most notably by the students from Parkland, that it's time for us to stop reporting the names of the shooters, that's aggravating the situation. What are your thoughts on that?
I think we should expose them.
Yeah.
But the people need to know who is the cause behind the effect. You know, trying to brush it under the rug, y'all been doing that for so many years and it haven't gotten us anywhere. You know, so not saying their name is basically you kind of taking up for them. You know, they need to be exposed. They need to know that this is what you did and you have to take the fault for it.
Yeah. It breaks my heart as
I agree. I think it's more important that we talk about the victims.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you try to find out what brought them to this point. You can't learn if you're hiding it, if you're not looking into it. It breaks my heart that we as adults are letting you kids down, because really, we can't solve this problem. They're telling us what to do, and no one's doing anything. So what is our next step? What do we do?
Part of being peace warriors, we like to attack the internal violence before it gets to the external violence. So we talk to them about, well, why was you feeling some type of way, what was the main cause? Because there's always a root to the cause, you know. And a lot of people fail to realize that no one wakes up one day and decides, oh, I'm going to shoot up a school, without having the actual reason, you know. And people fail to realize, they just say, oh, you shot up the school just because. But as peace warriors, we don't attack the person, we attack the force that causes that. So we more so focus on the internal violence before the external violence.
You are an amazing human being. Do you know that?
Thank you.
You really are. Her name is Audrey Wright. I'm sure we'll see her running a city or country someday, because you're really great at this. She has Peace Warriors going on at North Lawndale College Prep. Is there a place we can send people to find out about Peace Warriors? Is there some way that other kids at other schools can start something similar?
We've actually had partnerships around the city of Chicago with different high schools and middle schools. We have a summer program that's getting ready to start up next month, where we actually will be sending peace warriors around the city of Chicago to train different groups, train different high schools. But I mean, if someone wants to find more about peace warriors, they can come to our school. That's where the action happens at. So they can talk to me, or they could talk to Mr. Gerald Smith.
No website though, Audrey?
No, we don't have one. Okay. Not one.
But Audrey and her team are very involved in March for Our Lives and the larger organizing group. So if anybody reaches out to March for Our Lives in Chicago, they will eventually connect with Audrey and many folks like
her. We have a connection with March for Our Lives, Chicago, Brave, St. Sabina. We have a lot of...
Good.
Yeah.
Great.
And Phil, I know we had you on today because of the Lori Dan shooting, but please come and visit us when we have more time and we can discuss this again. We'd really love that to happen.
I look forward to it.
Thank you so much. Good luck to you, Audrey. Audrey Wright from North Lawndale College Prep, and Phil Andrew, Director of Violence Prevention Initiatives for the Archdiocese of Chicago. Thank you so much, and good luck in your fight.
Thank you.
It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder at 720 WGN.
Zorn, the greatest father in all the land. Zorn, 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 we sing the praises of Zorn.
Harold Zorn is here, Wendy, from the Chicago Tribune.
Wait, I was singing the praises.
Oh, were you still singing his praises? I'm sorry.
Do not interrupt her when she's singing my praises, Bill.
Very quickly, we just had Phil Andrew in, who was one of Lori Dan's shooting victims 30 years ago. So here's two connections really quickly. Steve Bertrand in our newsroom was on the scene 30 years ago covering this for WGN. And in a story that will be told very soon, tomorrow, had something to do with how the story ended up.
Yep.
I don't want to give too much away. Eric Zorn was one of the co-writers of the book about the incident.
Right. George Papajohn and Joel Kaplan and I wrote a book called Murder of Innocence that came out in 1990. And it came out of a magazine article that the three of us had done for the Tribune Sunday magazine about trying to find out what was wrong with Lori Dan.
Yeah.
What you know, everyone knew that she was like deranged, but what was her condition? What was missed? Who could have done something? Why didn't they do it? That kind of thing. So we spent a lot of time talking to her ex-husband, Russell Dan, and trying to talk to people who had treated her, some of her psychiatrists, and following some of the trails where she had lived before, what people had noticed about her, and trying to figure out what was the condition, what had happened to her. So,
yeah.
And you know, the thing about this, I also wrote about this story a couple weeks ago. One of the kids, who is now 38 years old, who was shot, Peter Monroe, has written about a 17,000 word autobiographical essay and posted it online about what it meant to him to be shot, and in one of these schoolhouse shootings, how it affected him over the years, and how he's come through it. He's doing fine now.
He couldn't talk about it for quite some time.
That was the hard part of it, reporting this story, was that community, you know, a lot of places where reporters will go and someone is shot, a lot of people want to talk. They want to, you know, unburden themselves,
right.
talk about their experiences. We couldn't get not a single family of the children who were shot at the time would have let us talk to the kids who had survived.
That's how it was back then, though. No one wanted to.
I think it's some of it was Winnetka. Some of it is that kind of suburban. I mean, they're very closed off. And if you go into sort of more urban areas, people, I think, are much more willing to talk. I think this was one thing like they really felt, as they should have, very violated by this. And they just, in some ways, wanted to put it behind them. There was a big controversy, I remember, about whether they should name a park after Nicholas Corwin, who was a little boy who was killed. And they did.
Yep.
But there were people in the community who were saying, like, no, we don't want his name. It'll just remind us of this unpleasantness.
But so, that was a different time. Now we, as you talk about it, you get...
Well, if you remember what a big story that was, it was 30 years ago yesterday, and it was on the cover of People magazine. Nightline devoted, I think, at least one night to it. It was international news.
And
for several days. And now, you know, if one kid is killed in a school shooting, I think it would be like a 1 day or 2 day story.
Yeah,
you know, now we're talking about what it was. How many people were killed in Santa Fe, Texas? Was it 10?
10, I believe. 10.
I mean, just hearing about that, you just kind of. I mean, it's become so common now.
All right, so school shootings and mass shootings have become common, but the other uncommonality in all this, and we've talked about this with John Duffy on more than one occasion, is that it's rare that it's a woman that pulls this off, that when guys do it, it seems to be, you know, you deal with it. You go, well, that's the aggression that a male has. But when a woman does it, it's even stranger.
And the thing about it is that you don't want to stigmatize mental illness. We talk about this was mental illness, this was a mental health problem. And it certainly was in Lori Dan's case. She was a severely troubled young woman. But there are lots and lots of people, the vast majority of people who have mental illness are not dangerous to others, and sometimes not even to themselves. So you don't want to say, well, they're mentally ill, that we have to lock them away, presumptively keep them from people and so on. So that's a danger when you talk about this, when you're trying to diagnose, especially in retrospect, what was wrong with her. But she was on a bunch of different medications, and doctors had diagnosed her in various different ways. No one ever really knew what the problem was, but it was a psychosis of some sort, certainly. Because she was, I don't know if you remember the story, but she was like collecting raw meat.
Yeah, it was.
And things like that. So.
Typical behavior.
No, and very sad. But, in retrospect, only one kid killed, it seems like, oh, well, gee, that's hardly anything anymore now, given how often it happens.
Unfortunately,
and how many kids,
you're right.
I know, it's so sad. So,
all right, let's do this. We'll take a quick break, and then something you wrote, Eric, very recently that's getting a lot of attention. We'll discuss that next. It's Bill and Wendy, along with Eric Zorn on WGN. Eric Zorn is here from the Chicago Tribune. So, Eric, you wrote this column that's gotten all kinds of attention, and rightfully so. Please explain.
Well, it's interesting. A couple of weeks ago, a guy on Twitter posted something. He said, whenever I think I'm still young, I remember there's a whole generation of people who don't know what a dial tone sounds like. Which I thought, well, yeah, that's probably true.
Yep. There it is.
It's a dial tone. A lot of kids out there going, what's that?
They think we're being invaded by Martians.
So I started thinking about other sounds that have disappeared, that are either gone or are disappearing, and I'd never really thought of it in terms of the sonic portrait of our life imprint. But I came up with some here, and people have been writing to me all weekend. This came out online on Friday. The ka-ching of a manual cash register.
Oh, yeah.
I love that
cash
sound.
Cash registers are not gone. People still say ka-ching, but the cash register doesn't do it anymore, right?
Uh-huh.
And if Jasmine has some of these, she could signal us when she's got some.
Is this it?
What is this?
Listen.
Yeah, this
maybe
is
she
it.
Should play some.
Oh, there it is. The
why
ka-ching.
Why don't she play a couple? Can you play a couple, Jasmine?
And we'll guess what they are. Typewriter?
Rotary dial phone.
Is that what it is? I can't
no.
See.
No. What
was
it?
What is that, Jess?
It's a camera. You know how you do the camera.
Oh, the camera.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. I didn't thought about
Remind
that.
Remind us again what a camera is.
It's like a phone, but without the phone.
Without the phone part of the phone?
They still sell them.
Yeah, they do? All right.
Yeah, they do. I'm told they do.
Next sound.
Now, some people have
that. Is this the party to whom you are speaking?
Now, this sound is when people do have it on, that they have this retro sound on their cell phones,
right.
Kind of an ironic thing, but for the most part, people don't. I mean, even your phone at home doesn't have that sound anymore, so.
Yeah.
Next. Space Invaders. Boy, I'm embarrassed for both of
Pac-Man.
Us.
Pac-Man.
Oh, is it Pac-Man?
Oh, yeah.
So
oh, there's Blinky, Inky, and Sue.
Yep.
Pinky, Blinky, Inky, and Sue.
Oh, this is on your TV set, right?
When it stops
broadcasting?
No, you have flatlined.
Oh, no, I'm dead?
What is this?
Is that what it is?
I don't recognize
this
one.
Is it ZX Spectrum?
Oh, is this the...
This is getting on to...
Dial-up?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's certainly one of them was the way the whir and click, the shrieks and buzzes when you connect.
Yeah, this is pretty.
Modem, so.
Beep, boop, bop, bop, beep, beep, beep.
There it is.
Bonk, bonk, bonk.
That dial-up modem sound. Now, that's something that... So I'm sure my kids are going to be 21.
They would know this
month.
Noise.
They would not know this noise.
Like, but when you heard it, wasn't it great? Because it meant you were finally
the internet
online.
Online. Yeah.
Yeah.
And no one in the house could use the phone after.
Right.
I got one more.
Yeah.
All right. Rain.
That's the static from the TV.
Static on the TV. Oh. With my TV, I still get static if I hit the wrong button and I go to like over air television.
Oh, right.
And it goes off a dish. I still hear that. A couple more. We have time for a few more.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the whir and click of a movie projector.
Yes.
You know, followed by the flap, flap, flap.
I love that.
Runs out.
Yeah.
Good job.
A backfiring car.
Oh, we used
cars don't backfire anymore.
That always scared me. I always thought it was gunshots.
That was in cartoons. It was common. Like if you were watching the Wacky Races, the Ant Hill Mob's car would always backfire.
Bam,
And any jalopy.
I believe the Beverly Hillbillies car.
They also did. Right.
The teletype machine, the sound of a teletype machine and a new, you know.
I love that sound too.
And what about, there it is.
Is that it? Yeah?
Yeah.
Nice, Jess.
There's also the sound of a dot matrix printer. Do we have that?
I don't know if I remember that sound.
Is that there? It would go like
squeak, squeak, squeak. Oh, right.
Yeah. I can do that. We don't need Jasmine. I can do these.
Who needs Michael Winslow anymore?
Eric's got that job.
That's the printer. Yeah.
Wait, that's not from Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea? That's what it sounds like.
Well, just the sound of a manual typewriter and that tunk when you would the carriage return.
Yeah.
You just never hear that anymore.
Yeah.
What about the hiss? Behind a cassette tape, the music you'd listen to on a cassette tape, there was always that hiss. Even when you had Dolby, there was that hiss that you couldn't get rid of in a cassette tape. I don't think anyone listens to those anymore. And what about the sound of a credit card imprinter? You know, rectangular thing where they go
slide.
They'd slide it over, make an imprint of it.
Yep.
Is that what's going on here?
That's a sprinkler.
It's the imprinting.
Oh, the imprinting.
I thought that was a sprinkler.
Well, this was an actual machine that you would... It was clunk, clunk, and you do it.
Yeah, you...
That sounded like someone like scratching with a pencil to get the...
Scratch off.
Pizza guy still does that.
Yeah. Well, just the sound of a 45 record dropping.
You know, I love that.
Changer dropping
Click.
Down.
Yeah.
And a couple people have been writing in with stuff, and some of them have been like at the crack of a wooden bat in a Little League game.
Yeah.
Which you just don't hear anymore, but you do hear the crack of a wooden bat in a baseball game, of course.
It's all aluminum in Little League now.
And people talk about, you do hear, people are still playing phonograph records, not nearly as much, but that sound, they do play them, they tend to be audiophiles, so you don't hear that, you don't have that
the sizzle?
That sizzle. And also with that pop where it hops over a crack.
Yeah.
You ever have a cracked record, you'd keep playing it because you liked it so much?
Right.
But there was always that, and you'd go over, you don't hear that sound anymore. how about the sound of a carousel slide projector?
Oh, beautiful sound.
Go,
yeah.
And then you hear the fan, the fan was always going really loud, so the background sound. what about the snap and grind of a flash cube camera?
I forgot about that sound.
Where
yeah.
it would turn.
Unmistakable.
So I'm asking people to write to me, Eric Zorn at Gmail, to if you've got other sounds like
this. I thought
of
three of them.
Yes, go.
All right. One is the sound when you would pull into a gas station, you would go over that thing, and it was to let the attendant know that you were there.
Right, and the only place you may hear that still is at like a oil change place.
Yeah, they still have them.
They
still have
them, but that's the only place. You're right, that's gone.
All right, so that's one. There's the jolt of an old pinball machine, like when you'd put your quarter in, as the game would start, the reels would turn, you'd hear the reels turn, and then there was like an electronic jolt as the game would kick in.
Like a big clunk?
Yeah.
Because it was all mechanical.
It was all mechanical.
And now they tend to be much more electronic, right?
Yeah, so that's gone. And the other one is, if you were shopping in a department store, there was this pleasant tone that they would play over the loudspeaker to let security know. It was like all encoded to say, we've got a problem in Sector 6, but all you heard was, bing!
Yeah, I remember that.
Like that, while you were shopping.
Someone said, but you don't hear the clunk of a thunk of a newspaper hitting your porch anymore, which I thought was sad. And
on Sundays,
I thought
you do.
That was sad and cruel. I wish they hadn't said that. And also, the, you know, the sound of a TV station going off the air for the night, you know, playing the national anthem, and then the test pattern would go.
Yeah.
Other people were saying that you don't hear the sound of chalk on a chalkboard because all the schools use whiteboards now.
Oh.
Now, I don't know that that's true.
It is true.
It is true.
Yeah. Okay. So you'd also miss out on the sound of a kid banging the erasers together at the end of the day to clean them.
Somebody had one that I thought was really good. Remember at the end of a baseball game, you would hear in the stand, the announcers would be like recapping the game, and in the stands you would hear that pop 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 of kids stepping on those wax cups.
Now
all the cups are plastic, they would just go crack. But I do remember that. I remember the announcers going, and then in the third inning this happened, and in the background you hear this pop pop, because kids were stepping on them. So,
I'm sorry, but it's the end of the record for you. We're out of time.
All right.
Well, Eric, that's a great column. You're going to do a follow-up soon.
I'm going to. I hope some of your listeners will write to me.
All right. And to reach you, they want to hit what?
EricZorn@gmail.com.
Easy. Thanks, Eric.
Thank you.
We'll take a look at what Steve Bertrand has next on the Wintrust Business Lunch. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.